All right. Well, then without further ado, I will get started. My name is Mimi Marziani. I'm an attorney with the Brennan Center in our democracy program. I work primarily on voting rights and campaign finance, which means that I have nothing to do these days, as you can imagine. I appreciate all of you guys coming out to talk a little bit more about what is broken in our democracy and what we can do to fix it. And so, to start, these are not good days for our democracy. In fact, these could be, and some say, these are the worst of times. Ideological courts and special interests have annihilated rules limiting big money in politics. So now, the amount of unregulated cash that is sloshing around the system is unprecedented in the post-Watergate era. And this phenomenon has dovetailed with another horrible trend. In the last 2 years, states have enacted the worst rollback of voting rights since the days of Jim Crow. Amazingly, these new restrictive laws target the very same people who just decades ago worked so hard for their voting rights: racial minorities, students, the poor, women. Together, these developments threaten full democratic breakdown. A government sold to the highest bidder while regular people are shut out of the auction altogether. But my story is not utterly tragic, and that is because the ending is not yet known. It's clear that our democracy is in dire straits. Big solutions are needed now. But Americans are beginning to push back against the super PACs and the dark money and the photo ID laws and everything else. In addition, there are concrete reforms that we can all rally behind to create a stronger democracy in 2013 and beyond, a democracy where campaigns are fueled by small donors and elections are open to all eligible voters. But before getting to the merrier stuff, let's think about whether or not this is the worst of times. And I'm going to start with the campaign finance breakdown. As many of you know, in January 2010, the Supreme Court struck down longstanding laws restricting corporate spending in elections, and this was in a case called Citizens United versus FEC. To justify its decision, the court offered two rationales. The first is very well known. The first rationale was that the identity of the speaker didn't matter, meaning that whether you are a person or whether you're a corporation, you have the same right to spend money to influence elections. The second rationale is perhaps even more important, although less discussed. The court also said, in striking down those laws, that independent spending, meaning spending that is not coordinated with any candidate, is not capable of causing corruption. And so these two rationales have led to three disastrous results. The first, that you can see right here, there's been an explosion of so-called independent spending. After Citizens United, for-profit and non-profit corporations can spend general funds directly to influence election results, and we are now in the midst of the most expensive cycle ever, and the Associated Press actually recently dubbed this the year of big money, and this obviously needs no further explanation. The second troubling trend is super PACs. And super PACs are not a direct result of Citizens United. That's a kind of common misbelief. Instead, court decisions after Citizens United expanded the Citizens United logic to say, well, if independent spending can't corrupt, then we have no reason to restrict contributions that are going to groups that tell us they're only going to engage in independent spending. And so these decisions created super PACs, which are mutant political committees that can collect and spend as much money as they want for and against candidates. They only have one restriction, which is they are not allowed to formally coordinate with any candidate campaign. And so there are two very important things to know about super PACs. One, the entire premise upon which they are based is ridiculous, right? I mean, if I'm running for office and you come up to me and tell me that you're going to spend $2 million on an ad blitz against me, then I am going to be pretty likely to listen to what you have to say and also pretty likely to do your bidding to the extent that I can. And obviously you're not proposing to coordinate with my campaign in any way. However, you can threaten me in a manner that is, I would say, corrupting. On the flip side, you know, if I come up, if Eric's running for Senate and I jump in and blow his opponent out of the water with a multi-million dollar ad blitz against his opponent, Eric is going to be pretty damn grateful for my very kind use of millions of dollars I don't have. And when he gets into office, you better believe that he's going to remember that I did that favor for him. So the entire premise underlying super PACs, this notion that independent spending can't corrupt, is not based in reality. The second problem is that the definition of coordination under federal law allows significant cooperation between candidates and super PACs. And so this has led to the candidate-specific super PAC. And as you can see right here, every major presidential candidate this year has an affiliated super PAC that is run by his closest friends, most trusted advisors, in John Huntsman's case, run by his father. I mean, people who are very, very close to the candidate. In addition, under the rules, without formally coordinating, Barack Obama has done things like send top White House officials to fundraise for his super PAC. Mitt Romney maybe did him one better and has retained the same political consulting firm as his super PAC, as well as the same event planning company. And so these are obviously extremely close ties between super PACs and the candidates. And so we are left in this topsy-turvy world where you know, Sheldon Adelson cannot give $20 million to Newt Gingrich directly, but can give $20 million to a super PAC that is wholly dedicated to Newt Gingrich, doing everything right in accordance with campaign strategy and with the candidate's full knowledge and implicit consent. And so the third threat, as if all of that wasn't enough, is dark money. It might surprise some of you to know that the dark money problem is not actually rooted in super PACs. Super PACs themselves are transparent. The problem is when Citizens United opened the door for corporations of all stripes to spend money directly on politics, they also worsened many existing loopholes in federal disclosure law. And so now we have a situation where a nonprofit corporation like a 501c4 or a 501c6 can collect donations. They are under no obligation to ever disclose those donations, but they can use those donations fairly freely to spend on campaign advertisements or to give to super PACs to spend on campaign advertisements. And this has led to literally millions of dollars sloshing around in the political system that we, the public, have no clear idea of where it came from. Unfortunately, the candidates probably do, which adds to the threat of corruption that is present in the super PAC phenomenon. So together, all of this, the new money, super PACs, the lack of transparency, these are raising serious threats to our democracy. And in fact, new polling commissioned by the Brennan Center shows that approximately 70% of Americans believe that super PAC spending will lead to corruption. Even worse, in my opinion, is that roughly one-fourth of people surveyed, with even higher numbers for African Americans, Latinos, and folks with in a lower income bracket, nearly one-fourth of respondents said that they are less likely to vote because of the disproportionate influence the super PAC donors have. And so this brings me to the second part of my worst of times story, and this is our march backwards from Selma. In the last roughly year and a half, Thank you. There have been a wave of new state laws that make voting harder. And in fact, to give you down and dirty numbers, as of April 2012, there were 25 new laws in 18 states that, by the Brennan Center's calculations, will make it exceedingly more difficult for about 5 million Americans to cast a vote. And on top of that, there are 47 more bills currently pending. As you can imagine, as I'll explain in a second, the persons hardest hit by these new laws are the very ones who are the most vulnerable in our society. And so what do these new laws do? Well, a couple of things. One, they restrict voter registration. Maine, for instance, passed a law eliminating its wildly popular Election Day registration program that has been used by over 50,000 in each election. Florida and Texas shut down voter registration drives, also relied upon by hundreds of thousands of eligible voters. And other laws have made it harder for those who move, who tend to be younger and of lower income, to stay registered when they move addresses. In addition, I'm sure heard a lot about, there are several states that are now demanding very strict forms of photo identification in order to vote. And these new photo ID laws have become, they've been put into place in 10 states now. These laws demand current and valid, very specific forms of government-issued photo identification. And unfortunately, about 1 in 10 eligible voters do not have these types of identifications. And there are even higher percentages of, again, racial minorities, students, the poor, women, elderly, that don't have this type of identification. To add insult to injury, many of these jurisdictions in enacting these new laws have made selective judgments that just blatantly discriminate against certain segments of the population. One of my favorite examples is Texas. I can pick on Texas because I used to live there. My former home state of Texas has a passed a voter ID law that will accept a concealed handgun license as proper ID, but not student ID. And you can imagine the demographics of folks who hold those different types of identification. And if you can't, let me tell you, the people who have concealed handgun license are older, whiter, richer, predominantly male. The students that go to a school like University of Texas are of all ages, from all types of backgrounds. And so this graph right here, this just shows you photo ID laws before 2011. And you can see the new map, you add basically 10 red states onto what we saw just 2 years ago. In addition, other new laws require documentary proof of citizenship in order to register or to vote. At least 7% of Americans don't have this documentation with their original name on it. This is another thing I can attest to. I mean, I changed my name when I got married. My birth certificate does not say my current name. And so if I had to prove my citizenship, that could be a serious problem. And it is for many, many people. In addition, other states have reduced early and absentee voting. We've seen that in at least 5 different states. And at least 3 states have made it harder for hundreds of thousands with past felony convictions to restore their voting rights. And so I'm going to quickly shine a spotlight on our Hall of Shamer winner, which is Florida. Florida enacted a new law last year that restricts voter registration drives, eliminates early voting, makes it harder to stay registered after you move, and cuts the shelf life of citizens' initiatives in half. And this is one of the primary sponsors of this law. This was what he said when asked to justify the law's existence. In their effort to make voting not easy, one of the early voting days that Florida eliminated was the Sunday right before Election Day. On that Sunday in 2008, African American churches in particular were very successful in what was called the Pews to the Polls program, getting people after church to head over and cast a vote. And in fact, in 2008, over one-third of voters who cast a vote on that Sunday before Election Day in Florida were African American, even though African Americans make up only 13% of the state voting age population. Similarly, about 25% of those who cast a vote that Sunday were Latino, even though Latinos only make up about 16% of the voting age population. Finally, on top of all of this, Florida made it extremely difficult to conduct voter registration drives and effectively shut down efforts of groups like the League of Women Voters and Rock the Vote to go out into the community and add new people to the rolls. And then actually finally, as many of you guys have heard, and I can maybe talk about during the question period, Florida has very recently announced its intention to purge suspected non-citizens, and many of them from the polls. So that's the bad news. But now I'm going to talk a little bit about the good news, and then I'm going to give you guys a chance to ask questions. So the real good news of the story is that the ending is yet unknown. And first, there are signs, very important signs, that citizens are starting to push back against these threats to our democracy. And one pushback I want to highlight is a case called American Tradition Partnership versus Montana. In late December, the Montana Supreme Court, in a case that most people, including those of us in the field, were not really paying any attention to, the Montana Supreme Court upheld Montana's law restricting corporate expenditures in elections. If that sounds familiar, that's because that is basically the exact same law that was struck down in Citizens United on the federal level. And Montana, in upholding the law, they looked at Montana's long history and struggles with political corruption, particularly corporate capture of their governmental systems. The plaintiffs immediately sought a temporary ruling from the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court did, in fact, stay the ruling, which means that while litigation is moving forward in the Supreme Court, corporations can continue to spend in Montana. But, very importantly, in staying the Montana Supreme Court decision, Justices Ginsburg and Breyer released a very unusual concurrence to the stay order. In that concurrence, they said, and this is worth quoting, so I want to quote, "Montana's experience and experience elsewhere since this court's decision in Citizens United make it exceedingly difficult to maintain that independent expenditures by corporations do not give rise to corruption or the appearance of corruption." And in doing that, kind of lawyer speak, they were basically saying, look, we don't buy Citizens United. It wasn't right then, and new evidence is showing that it is particularly not right now. And so this litigation has gone forward. The plaintiffs filed a brief with the court asking the court to simply strike down the Montana decision without even holding oral argument on the matter, which is fairly rare. The Montana filed a brief in response saying, no, you know, we're right, let our decision stand, or in the alternative, at least give Montana its day in court. Let us tell you, Supreme Court, about Montana's problems with corporate corruption and about the problems we're seeing across the country. At this stage in a Supreme Court case, it's called the petition for certiorari stage, the stage where the Supreme Court is just deciding whether or not to hear a case. It's very rare for other people who aren't parties to the case to weigh in. However, in this case, there were a huge number of people who weighed in. The vast majority of them, over a dozen different briefs were filed by all sorts of people telling the Supreme Court that they should either A, let Montana's decision stand, or B, give Montana its day of court. The Brennan Center, and I brought a prop. We actually filed one of these briefs. You can find it on our website if you're interested. We represented about, I've been so busy. You'll have to count and double check me. I think it was 10 or 12 constitutional scholars. And in doing so, we made the argument that, in fact, independent spending can be corrupting. And not only can it be corrupting, it is corrupting. And we laid out lots and lots of facts about super PACs and about the problems facing our democracy right now. This Montana decision has also dovetailed with an uptick in citizen action across the country. And as I'm sure many of you have actually been involved with, in dozens and dozens of jurisdictions, from Los Angeles to New York and everywhere in between, small local government councils and some state governments have been passing resolutions either calling upon the Supreme Court to overturn Citizens United or calling on Congress to do something to fix the situation. In addition, some state citizens are pushing back by enacting new laws to strengthen disclosure and to do other things to push back against the decision. As I told some of our allies from Rhode Island just a minute ago, I just got word that Delaware passed a new campaign finance disclosure bill. So there is definitely some positive progress going on. The court meets on June 14th to decide whether or not it's going to take this case. And everybody should keep your eyes on the Brennan Center's website, keep checking the news to see what happens, because this could be a really big deal if the Supreme Court decides to hear this case. And so, quickly, because I want to make sure you guys have time for questions, we're also seeing some extremely positive backlash at the state level with regard to the voting laws. In Maine, last November, voters rejected the legislature's efforts to eliminate Election Day registration by reinstating EDR through petition. Similarly, in Ohio, over 300,000 citizens signed a petition to freeze a new law that was passed there that would have limited early voting in that state. In Texas and in South Carolina, the Department of Justice has stepped in and has refused to accept the new photo ID laws in those states under the Voting Rights Act. Litigation is ongoing in both those matters, and the Brennan Center is also involved in both of those litigations. We've jumped into the litigation on the side of the Department of Justice, obviously, to tell the court the ways that these laws discriminate against racial minorities. In Wisconsin, we also saw a state court strike down that state's new photo ID law, looking at the state constitution, which is another exciting development. And then Florida, coming back to Florida. In Florida, the state is also ensnarled in Voting Rights Act litigation concerning all of the changes in its law. The Brennan Center is involved with that litigation. The Brennan Center also, on behalf of the League of Women Voters, Rock the Vote, and other organizations, sued the state directly, claiming that the new law restricting voter registration drives infringes on our clients' constitutional rights of free speech and association. Very exciting. Last week, we got a win in this case. The court has preliminarily frozen key segments of the voter registration drive law. And in doing so, the court said, "Together, speech and voting are constitutional rights of special significance. They are the rights most protective of all others. When a plaintiff loses an opportunity to register a voter, that opportunity is gone forever. Allowing responsible organizations to conduct voter registration drives, thus making it easier for citizens to register and to vote, promotes democracy." And so just yesterday, in fact, League and Rock the Vote had a joint press conference down in Florida, and they announced that they are going to restart their voter registration effort shortly. In addition to all of this activity, there are also some important systemic reforms. How are we doing on time? So I'm just going to highlight these quickly, and then if you guys want to hear more, I can either answer questions during question and answer, or we can talk about it afterwards. Three extremely important reforms, which you can learn all about, again, at the Brennan Center's webpage. And I have another prop, and a new publication that we just released called New Ideas for a New Democracy. There are three main reforms that we lay out. One, voter registration modernization. The quick and dirty explanation is put the onus on the government to register people to vote. We can do that using existing lists, like the Social Security lists, all sorts of things we use to track down people for the draft and to pay their taxes. I mean, there's ways that we could register people to vote. We could also do this at the state level by combining all sorts of different states or all sorts of different lists that states have currently. And we need to make sure that all of this stuff is automated so that when I move, for instance, from Texas to New York, I don't have to re-register, that my registration can just move with me. Second important reform is small donor public financing. And in a nutshell, this is a model of public financing that supercharges small donations based off of New York City's groundbreaking program. In New York City, for instance, if I collect $100 from one of my constituents, that $100 donation is matched with $600 of public funds. And so this program and these types of public financing models allow, one, it allows citizens to make much more of an impact with their regular dollars rather than millions of dollars. Two, it incentivizes candidates to get down into the neighborhood and to actually campaign to regular people. And in fact, when we study the campaigns of candidates, for instance, in New York City, you see that they look very, very different than campaigns of people in other comparable big cities or other states or at the federal level. In addition, through small donor public financing, we can, if designed properly, we can give candidates the ability to make themselves heard over the super PACs and to get their message out there and ultimately, you know, beat back the candidates that are sponsored with a corporate logo tattooed on their head. And then finally, progressive jurisprudence. Without going into a lot of detail, many, many of these changes have been made possible by a long push to change the way that we think about constitutional law. This, you know, in my opinion, in Brennan Center's opinion, we have been moving in the wrong direction in this front. We need to be promoting constitutional law that embraces robust voting rights, that embraces widespread, meaningful, democratic participation, and that advances our country's long tradition of deliberative democracy rather than, you know, some sort of democracy of the marketplace. And finally, with this, I think we all need to recognize that promoting and protecting our democracy is one of the most important things we can do to protect not only our government, but our Constitution and all the values on which this country was founded. So with that, I will turn it over to you, and I welcome your questions.
My understanding, particularly in terms of the Voting Rights Act, that this is the first time that we've had a Democratic administration during a voting cycle, and so that we're seeing the DOJ step in appropriately because they believe in the Voting Rights Act as a law. But I also hear that some of these cases are being taken trying to bypass the DOJ directly to the Supreme Court, and that the intention is to try to overturn the Voting Rights Act. And so I was just wondering, from the Brennan Center's point of view, how likely do you think that is, that the Voting Rights Act, which is particularly in places like Florida and Texas, is our only protection, even though it's only occurred once, it's certainly important, will be overturned?
Sure. So there's a lot in your question, but let me try to address some of these points. I mean, one, I mean, in my opinion, the reason that we are seeing so much pushback from the Department of Justice right now is because of these new laws. I mean, we haven't seen anything like this since the civil rights era. And so I don't actually think it is, really has anything to do with what party is in power or the timing of the election so much as this wave of new laws. And the Department of Justice has been appropriately actually following very much the letter of its mandate under the Voting Rights Act. And yes, it is true that Florida, Texas, and South Carolina have all, you know, some more explicitly than others, have all, you know, said that they have no problem challenging the Voting Rights Act and that they believe it's unconstitutional. You know, this claim would be a lot easier to take if these places would actually stop passing laws that were so blatantly discriminatory. And so we will see what happens if and when a core challenge to the Voting Rights Act gets up to the Supreme Court. But the couple of lower courts that have now considered the issue, everyone has solidly upheld the Voting Rights Act.
Brennan Center or any of your allies have thoughts on vote by mail programs like in Washington and Oregon? Are you advocating for that?
Yeah, I mean, we are certainly, as kind of a broad statement, we are in favor of measures that make voting easier. And, you know, vote by mail, I know it's very popular in the Pacific Northwest and has been, you know, very successful out there. I haven't done the political science research necessary to tell you whether or not I think that would be good in every single state. States are very different, and people are used to going to the polls. So, you know, so I'm not sure if that would be a widespread solution. However, I do think that those states are certainly moving in the right direction in trying to identify ways to make voting easier for their eligible voting age population rather than harder.
I want to push back a little bit on the Montana case.
Yeah.
And the likelihood that it's going to yield a different result this time. I mean, yes, we have more facts right now about how independent speech does corrupt, but barring a change in membership on this mm-hmm. Supreme Court, you know, who among the five in that majority do we think cares about the facts?
Right. That is a somewhat sad question,
I'm
but
sorry.
It's I know. But yes, I take your point. It is a very good one. And I guess I would say, that, I mean, there's a couple of things. One, you know, I think that still the vast majority of constitutional scholars think that the Supreme Court will simply swat down the Montana case. So that's kind of the first thing to be aware of. If, however, they don't, if they take the case, I do think that that's a reason to be a little bit more hopeful of some sort of slightly different result. I do not think, no matter what, that we would see a full-scale reversal of Citizens United. I think that we could see you know, some tweaking of the language. I mean, there have been some interesting developments in Citizens United. For instance, the Blumen case, which I'm sure you're familiar with, where, you know, in Citizens United, there's very sweeping language about the identity of the speaker doesn't matter. When, you know, people who were living in the United States but are not citizens said, okay, well, then why can't I spend money to influence elections? And that went up to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court had an opportunity to take it, and they allowed the lower court decision to stand, which was basically upholding the law prohibiting foreigners from spending in this way. So that tells us, actually, that Citizens United was not completely correct when they said the identity doesn't matter. So some people think that the Supreme, you know, if they were to take Montana, they could give a more nuanced view of this identity of the speaker idea, and also, I mean, they truly decided Citizens United with absolutely no facts, and so there's at least some glimmer of hope, or maybe I just tell myself this, that the court could clarify that, you know, on the right factual record, there could be some sort of limitations placed on independent spending, or at the very least, that they didn't mean to mess up contribution limits to PAC.
Losing the case, you still raise the issues again before the public, which
right,
generates
right.
support for
that's
legislative
exactly right.
and potential
that's exactly
constitutional
right.
solutions.
That's exactly right. And we could, you know, another scenario, I guess, would be a complete loser of a decision, but where, you know, Kennedy writes a concurrence and says, look, I think that these non-coordination rules are crazy. You know, Congress, please do something. So that could be a partial victory as well. It's really something of a wild card. Great question, though.
I've always thought one way to put the onus on the government to voter rights would be to create mandatory voting. Is there anybody doing a big push for that?
You know, the only person I know who's been speaking a lot about mandatory voting is Norm Ornstein, who I adore, and he's a political scientist based at American Enterprise Institute. He speaks very persuasively about mandatory voting. However, I don't think that it would ever happen in this country. I mean, we have a very, you know, even people who identify as progressive and agree that government has a large role to play in the shaping of society, you know, even people in that camp tend to have a libertarian streak that you don't see, I think, in a country like Australia where voting is mandatory. So it's hard for me to conceive of a situation where that could be passed. Although, personally, I think that it's a very attractive argument.
About the Voting Rights Act, do you think the DOJ will need to address or modernize Section 5, which was based on the history, so that history of discrimination, so that a state like Rhode Island would have the same kind of federal oversight as Texas and Florida?
That's a great question. And in fact, I guess to be a little bit more clear, the challenge is, you know, it's kind of commonly reported that these states are challenging the Voting Rights Act. Really what they're doing is challenging Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, which is a special provision that for certain jurisdictions that have a history of racial discrimination in voting laws, before they can change their law in any way as it pertains to voting, it has to be approved by the federal government. And this is a fairly unusual provision because typically, a duly enacted state law is presumed constitutional. And somebody challenging the law has to show that it's not. In this case, it shifts the burden in a very important way. And people who are challenging the Voting Rights Act are particularly critical of the formula that is used to determine whether or not a jurisdiction is covered. The Supreme Court a couple years ago certainly made some statements suggesting that the coverage formula should be looked at and updated. Congress reauthorized the Voting Rights Act, including Section 5, in 2006. In doing so, it considered tens of thousands of pages of evidence. So there is a lot of evidence on the record supporting their decision to keep the formula the same. Whether or not a court decision could force Congress to go back and update the formula, perhaps, that kind of remains to be seen. However, as I said, I mean, the two courts that have thus far recently considered this issue have said that it was fine, that the Congress considered a lot of evidence in 2006 and that they fulfilled their duty to justify Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act.
I think your presentation today really illustrates some of the cognitive dissonance we see on the other side of the aisle from this. On the one hand, they'll have you believe that individual voters need to present ID in order to vote. On the other hand, some rich person or corporation who wants to buy the election, well, they can remain secret. And before we can really win on this issue at all, we need to win in the court of public opinion. I wonder if there's any impetus to try and use this kind of dichotomy to say, look, we have to have something to convince people that this is the right thing to do.
Absolutely. I guess on kind of a broader answer to your question is there are groups, like the Brennan Center. There's tons and tons of wonderful groups out there that are engaged in very aggressive communication strategy to try to educate the public about these issues. And in fact, you could ask Eric, the Brennan Center sent me all over the place in the last, particularly in the last couple of months, as people are starting to pay more attention to these issues. I can say specifically that, there is a lot of anger about Citizens United and about the current state of campaign finance, and we've done, as I said, we've done some recent polling, found it on our website. I think that the public is squarely on the side of those who think there should be reasonable regulations in that area. Photo ID is definitely a more complicated subject. It has become one extremely politicized, and so it's been difficult, I think, to step away from the partisan politics and to really think about, okay, what problem are we trying to solve here? And, is this the right solution? And can we justify the burden that this poses on lots and lots of eligible voters? And I think that really requires, that conversation requires actual facts and cooler heads. And that's been a little bit more difficult, I think, to communicate broadly for those reasons. But we're certainly doing our best to try.
I am not going to stand up.
Yes, I definitely excuse you.
I wonder if you could talk a little bit about helping us frame how to think about super PACs and independent expenditures in local elections or state-level elections, mm-hmm. because I think while I agree with everything that is said and kind of the unfortunate circumstances we have with super PACs, we do have people on the left that have made the decision at the national level to engage in them, our president being one of them, right, to not be taken over. And I think, unfortunately, in local elections and statewide elections, especially when you look at Democratic primaries, challengers face a real disadvantage when it comes to thinking about how to raise money and how to use independent expenditures or take money from PACs, be they super PACs or not, right? And so I'm running for state senate, and it would be helpful to have some ways to think about that and articulate a position. When we're in a situation where the reality is that Democratic incumbents and likely my opponent can write himself one check and or receive a lot of money from PACs because of the fact that he's been around for a while. Mm-hmm. So just that would be helpful to get some ways to kind of think about that and articulate positions on it. In the super PAC world, right? How do we be of the world and not, what is it, in the world and not of it?
Right. I have never run for office myself, so I guess I don't completely understand, but I can, I hear what you're saying, and I know that that's very hard. I'm not sure that there's a, silver bullet or, kind of easy, correct answer. I think that it all depends on what you're looking at. I mean, the thing about super PACs is there are some groups that are outside of a candidate's control. And I think that a candidate has a bully pulpit and can say, I'd much rather you be helping, supporters, thank you, but I'd much rather you be helping me by collecting small donations and getting feet on the ground and doing things to spread a positive message in a way that's not through, television commercials. I also think that there is a way for candidates to try to set the tone of the debate, and obviously you can imagine the various ways to do that, but that's another particular problem with super PACs and other outside groups is that there's no accountability. I mean, a candidate at the end of the day, you have to watch what your campaign ads say because, you might end up in you might end up elected, and some people could hold that against you, or you want to run again, and people will remember. So there's an accountability on candidates that's not there with the outside groups, and the best thing to do, I think, as a candidate, is to say, look, if you are going to spend money, you need to be honest, and we want to keep the tone positive, and I'd rather you be supporting me than attacking my opponent. As far as ways to kind of rise above the din of the super PACs, I mean, you know, I am not a political strategist at all, but I do personally take hope when I talk to people like Zephyr Teachout, who worked for Dean's campaign several years ago. She's written a lot about using technology to innovate political campaigns. And I stay hopeful that there are ways, you know, with Twitter and Facebook and the internet generally, and a couple of states, I know Maryland and California are considering new laws, which I think are fantastic, that would allow you to text, political text to donate to a political candidate. I mean, so there are a lot of ways that we can encourage widespread participation, and at the end of the day, I think that will be our best weapon against the super PACs. I mean, you know, as Heather Smith, the president of Rock the Vote, always says when she talks to students who are dispirited because of super PACs, you know, at the end of the day, they are spending all this money to influence your vote. And, you know, a super PAC cannot put a gun to your head, thankfully, and tell you who to vote for at the ballot box. So, yeah, not yet. Right.
Mm-hmm. Push back on a little bit about the negative campaigning, right? I mean, because... No, that I guess I hadn't even thought of my question in that framework, right? But there, I mean, this came up recently. Mm-hmm. I'm working with a direct mail consultant who's very progressive, mm-hmm. Emily's List trained, you know, does a lot of female progressive candidates, and she, you know, wrote to me and said, okay, you know, you got to get all these pictures and all these direct mails, and, you know, we're going to have to do X number of negative pieces, you know, or comparative pieces. And I just wrote back and I was like, I'm uncomfortable with negative pieces. Let's talk about this. And she wrote back and said, think about it as giving voters a choice, right? And so there's this pushback yeah. around negative campaigning, right? And yes, you know, Swift yeah. Vote Veterans for Truth, you know, kind of putting out questionable pieces of information about the opponent's past, right, is one thing. But then the question of whether or not, you know, if right. you're going to make a negative ad, right, There are some political strategists that say, let the PAC do it,
right.
because then you, as the candidate and as the female candidate, don't come off as,
right.
you know, the bitch, you right, know, or right, whatever right. it is. Let somebody else do it, right? So I mean, yeah, there's just real tensions there because on the one hand, candidates do need to draw distinctions between themselves mm-hmm. and their opponents, and the question is, what's the most honest mm-hmm. way to do that?
Right. And you know, again, I'd love to talk to you maybe after the presentation. You know, I certainly can understand that dilemma. I guess one more thing just to think about is there are ways to frame oneself as, you know, running on a platform of democracy. And, you know, you want to reform democracy and you're not going to be part of the problem and you refuse to do it. And when you are elected, you're going to make sure that everybody has a meaningful voice and that, you know, you can do your best to keep the dialogue honest at the very least. So, yeah. Yeah, no. It's let me tell you, I mean, kind of the broader question, it is certainly a huge problem when one party adopts, you know, certain techniques and leaves the other party in a situation where, you know, I think that many candidates this election season feel like they either have to get down into the mud or pack their bags and go home, and it's definitely tough. So let's get another question. One more question? Okay.
Can you maybe inform, I know I think a lot of the dysfunction in campaign finance came from the Supreme Court ruling, but part of it comes from the fact also that the FEC is currently crippled, short a commissioner and you know,
the
no rulings.
The FEC is worthless.
Right. So
I'll throw out a much
so
harsher
my,
term.
My curiosity is kind of one is what's the solution to the FEC? Two, they're all kind of related. Why hasn't the president appointed another commissioner that would actually start to unclog some of these decisions? Because I think that there is some of this can be, some of the dysfunction can be solved through administrative rulings. And it won't solve all of it, but it could solve some of it. But what's the rationale for that? Why is there no public pressure to have a functioning FEC? Kind of all of the related FEC problems at the commission itself.
Yeah, I mean, there are, you flagged a ton of problems that unfortunately there's no good answer. I mean, the FEC was created to be a stalemate agency, basically, with three people from each political party. And that's fine when you have people in the agency who are truly thinking about the public good and about good policy rather than partisan politics. However, we've had people time and time again who are more interested in partisan politics, and the result has been this continuous 3-3 vote deadlock. Citizens United was one of the most important changes to campaign finance law, at least, you know, that happened in one fell swoop that we've seen in a very long time, and the FEC has basically not been able to respond, and that's a huge problem. And they're also, crippled on the enforcement front, all sorts of problems. There are proposals out there to reform the FEC, I mean, essentially, you know, bomb it and start again. I think that citizens should be thinking very seriously about those proposals and rallying around that. I think that I can't speak to Obama's motivations as far as nominating. I can say that, he has this problem that that campaign finance has become such a partisan issue that he does have this problem that no matter what he does nomination-wise, we're still going to see the 3-3, and it's likely going to be the same result. And then when you factor in the filibuster and just the problems that we've been seeing nominating people to agencies generally, that probably explains the problem. But, the broader point, I agree with you completely. The Brennan Center, I can certainly say that I don't do nearly as much work as I should be doing promoting FEC reform. It's a wildly important issue, and maybe we can all, I know it's not quite as sexy as, super PACs, but it is wildly important and something that maybe we can all be thinking about ways to drum up support for reform. More? Okay.
Thank you. I wanted to make a comment, really, and
sure.
A question, and highlight the quote you put up from a Florida state senator.
I can even go.
Yeah, and I think
I'm not very good at tech stuff, but I can do that.
Right, but what we've really got here is a situation where you have people who, and that's about as close as I've seen an elected official say what they really believe, which is that
this
there are people.
Fairly extraordinary. Right,
which is there are people who deserve to vote, and there are people who don't deserve to vote.
Yeah.
And if you can't figure out how to get that license, or you're too incompetent to overcome these minimal barriers, then you don't really deserve to vote anyway. And that's really the attitude behind their thinking. And so, from a moral perspective, that's, I think, what we've got to keep in our minds. And that's a way of attacking, in down and dirty politics, a way of attacking these new restrictions.
That's absolutely, absolutely right. And actually, there's an extremely good book by Alexander Kaser, thank you, chronicling the right to vote and in this country. And you can see, voter registration, for instance, originally put in place to keep the right people voting. And, literacy laws, all sorts of, you can go back in time. And actually, if you look around the turn of last century, you can see people who considered themselves to be very progressive and very enlightened making arguments that, if they're not educated enough, they really shouldn't be voting. Or if they can't read, we don't want them voting. We only want this kind of enlightened class to be picking our representatives. And to be honest, I clearly was not there for a number of reasons, but, you know, many of our founding fathers would probably agree with that statement, unfortunately. However, you know, our country has very proudly progressed since then, and we have gotten more and more inclusive in our democratic structures, and that is also, quite frankly, one of the reasons that this recent wave of laws is so troubling, because it is a regression in an area that we've, I mean, it hasn't been a perfectly forward march, but it has certainly, the overall trend has been decidedly forward, and it is extremely scary to see us taking these jumps backwards. So with that, I'm going to end, but I will be around at least the rest of the day today at the conference. I have a business card. I'm easy to find, just mimi.marziani@nyu.edu, and I'd love to hear from all of you. Thank you.